This podcast is produced by KPP Financial. Steve Peasley, President. KPP Financial. Independent thinking, shared success. And now today's podcast.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Invest Talk. This is our October 9th, 2017 edition of Invest Talk. And I am back. I've been on an extended vacation, and now I am here, as always, to help you become an above-average investor. And now, a person's retirement portfolio is always a work in progress. In fact, your whole financial picture is certainly a work in progress. And there's always time for refinement and fine-tuning. And sometimes you need a complete overhaul. But first, it's important to come to an agreement with yourself. You need to acknowledge your strengths and your weaknesses, the type of investor you are, the goals that you have, and the time you have to execute on that particular strategy. How much time and effort are you willing to commit to charting your investment course? So Steve and I, that's what we do each and every day for our clients and here on Invest Talk. We are here to help you make the best possible investment and financial decisions overall. So what's on tap for today? Now, within the past few months, the list of billionaire bull market dissenters has continued to grow. So are these worries justified? And we're talking about worries from George Soros and Jeffrey Gundlach, Howard Marks, Warren Buffett, etc. So we're going to talk about how 2000 and 2017 see a lot of similarities. So that's our main talking point today. Also, why the average retirement age is rising. Then why a Nobel Prize winning economist, sorry, not Nobel, he wrote a book on an economist who wrote a book on currencies. I don't think he won the Nobel Prize, but he wrote a book about currencies, is very bearish on Bitcoin for a particular reason. And it's a reason I think needs to be discussed a little bit more. And then why the Fed's policy is boosting commodity prices. Fed's tightening policy, usually you would expect that to be negative for commodity prices. In fact, it's having the opposite effect. So we're going to talk about that as well. So those are the things that are on my mind. But first, let's get to the phones. We try to answer your questions live during this hour, 4 to 5 Pacific time. Or you can leave your question, as always, on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.
Hello, Steve. Spencer out in Utah. Just had a question on the best way to analyze stocks. What program do you use? Is it Morningstar, or what do you go about, and how do you look at those different indicators? What advice would you have to somebody who's just starting out? Thanks.
Well, first thing you need to do is you know, if you're just starting out, is just read and understand what it all means. Right. You know, you talked about Morningstar, and we use Morningstar. We have a subscription to Morningstar. You could use it or, you know, not. You could subscribe to the subscription, or you can just use my favorite section, which is free on Morningstar.com, which is the key ratio section. It goes back 10 years and gives you all types of financial information about the business, from revenue, which is obviously very easy to understand, all the way down to complex figures like working capital, return on invested capital, intangible assets, accrued liabilities. You know, you start getting into the weeds a little bit if you want to, and that's certainly something that is an area that you need to educate yourself about and at least understand what it is. Maybe it's not a big part of your process, but for certain companies, certain industries, these maybe more in-depth terminology and areas of balance sheets and cash flow statements can be important. So it's really starting out. It's just understanding what these things are, the basics, how to understand the current, past, and future financial situation of every company and every industry. And that's certainly, I think, where you need to start. Then you can talk about where do you get your data. You know, we get it from Morningstar. We also, we use TD Ameritrade. So there's a lot of reports from Reuters and Bloomberg that we get as well from their research desk. We use Y charts. We use a lot of different pieces of software. I just probably talked about maybe a quarter of what we use. So there's a lot. MarketSmith is another one that's pretty good. And they all have their strengths and their weaknesses. And you need to understand that every piece of software is going to have that, right? Unless you subscribe to Bloomberg, and that's a whole nother beast. And that's $25,000 a year, which you probably aren't going to spend. So those are a few of the things that we use. But most importantly is, you need to know how to use the data. That's job number one. You could have all the data in the world, but if you don't know how to use the data correctly, it's not going to really get you anywhere. Now, I talked earlier about coming to grips with your own financial reality. That's the first step in designing your investment strategy. So do you have a complete grasp on what you own right now? I'm talking about your net worth and all of its parts. That's job number one. It's not just your investment portfolio. What other assets? Real estate. Hard assets. What about pensions in the future? Social Security. Right? Cash flows in the future. That's an asset. Even though you might not be able to touch it today, that's an asset as well. So that's something we work with clients, is developing a financial plan with all of their current assets and liabilities, right? Because owning a home might be worth $500,000, but if you owe $450,000 on it, is that really that much of an asset? Not a lot of equity in that property. So that's very important to know the balance between assets and liabilities and cash flows, both income and expenses today and in the future. And then you get into your risk tolerance and your goals, not just retirement, but it could be sending a kid to college, could be buying a boat. Now, it may sound silly for many folks, but their complete financial picture is a lot of times a little fuzzy. And it's a process that starts looking at your most recent statements for any investments and assets that you have. And then you zero in on what is what. What percentage is in stocks? What percentage is bonds, cash, real estate, commodities, etc.? Then you dedicate some time to managing those investments. And once again, that could be a real estate investment. Could be bonds, stocks. That's one great thing about stocks and bonds, is there's not a lot of thought process that goes into it. Especially compared to real estate. Right? Real estate takes a lot of time, managing properties, tenants, contractors, etc. Stocks, bonds still takes time, don't get me wrong. But it's usually less of a headache. Let's just say that, simplify it there. So think about this. The more stocks you own in proportion to funds, the more time it's going to take to manage your portfolio. Now, Ryan Barnes, who writes for Investopedia, believes that you need to devote 4 to 5 hours per week for research if you expect to do a good job managing your portfolio with a few individual stocks. Now, of course, the more knowledge and experience you have, the more efficient you'll be with your time. So that number can change over time, depending on your experience and how simple the companies are that you're investing in. Blue chip stocks take less time than maybe small cap stocks, because small cap stocks tend to have more upside than big blue chip stocks. So if you'd like to talk more about this or anything money related, let's talk. 888-99-CHART is our number. So we're going to get back to the phones right now. And actually, no, we're going to go to a break. Abraham Lincoln had advice for investors. He said, give me 6 hours to chop down a tree, and I will spend the first four sharpening the axe. Do you invest time before you invest money? Do you sharpen your axe? That's why you're here. So let's talk about it. Let's help. I want to help sharpen your axe, your investing axe. Let's talk about it. I'm here for you on Invest Talk.
Hi, this is Charlie in Modesto, and I'm calling about the J.P. Morgan Small Cap Equity Fund, which is a mutual fund, ticker symbol V as in Victor, S as in Sam, E as in Edward, A as in Adam, X as in X-ray. It's a load fund, but my brokerage was able to provide it with no front-end load and also no brokerage fee, and I've got it in Roth IRA, so no tax considerations. I've had it about a year and a half, and I've got a really nice run-up, but the chart's making me nervous. The ascent, as the price is climbing, it's just too steep, and I'm thinking about selling it, but I've just got this knot in my stomach wondering if I'm missing something here. So anyway, thought I'd see if I could get your comments on that, and I'll look forward to hearing your answer. Thanks.
All right, he's highlighting a pretty good fund, J.P. Morgan Small Cap Equity A shares, and he's talking about a load being waived, and that's good that he looked into that, and the fact that he's not being charged that happens sometimes with your broker for various reasons. Maybe you have enough money or a certain situation, might be in a 401k or whatever. A lot of times those loads can be waived, which is good that he's aware of that. No one should ever pay a load on a mutual fund, and this is a pretty good one. It's a small cap blend, growth focused. It has expense ratio about 1.25, which is okay. It's about average for a small cap fund. Performance over the longer term is pretty good, but I just don't like the space overall. I think small caps are very expensive. There's certainly one-off opportunities here and there in the space, but this is a name that is going to hold hundreds of different companies in it, and while it's a good fund, it certainly is going to be high risk. And if the small cap market, the market as a whole, turns around, and the market is certainly elevated for on many metrics, and small caps close to where they were in 2000 on a overvaluation standpoint. And so this is an area that I would take money off the table. Now, would I sell it all? I would really need to know your current situation, your goals, your time horizon, a little bit more to tell you how much you should sell. But, you know, you're up. I would take a little bit off the table, maybe all of it, depending on if you're trying to, how much you're trying to de-risk your overall portfolio. So that was VSEAX. Great call. Things that have done really well, especially growth-oriented funds, stocks, etc. They've had good runs, and they're definitely very, very frothy in this market. Now, this is Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein. Do you have a question? Well, I do. Are you prepared to do a complete fundamental analysis of a stock before you buy it? Do you understand what cash flow is, free cash flow, return on invested capital, financial leverage, right, debt to equity ratio, working capital, intangible assets? Do you understand what all these things are? Payout ratio, cash payout ratio. These are all facts and figures you need to be able to analyze before you go into buying a stock. So do you have a question? Let's talk about it. Reach me now on InvestTalk at 888-99-CHART. Some see similarities. That's our main talking point today, but I have some others as well that I talked about a little bit earlier. But let's first take a quick review of today's market. Now, we had a down day. It was it started up early on a positive note, and really we traded down for most of the day. The Dow ended down 12, S&P down 4, NASDAQ down 10. Very modest down day overall, but you had the likes of GE that was down the most in, I think, 10 years. They're kind of reshuffling their business. And overall, it just this recent run-up of the market looks it's overbought. So the big question is this the last hurrah melt-up, or is this just another pause for another leg higher? Only time will tell, but we certainly had a weak start to the day, or to the week, on this Monday. So that was the market for today, and we have an expectation for the Fed to raise rates maybe in November. Probably not. Probably December if they're going to do it. But that's what the market's starting to look at. Also looking at the ECB maybe raising rates in November. That's something the market is interested in. And we had a weak jobs report on Friday. Certainly there was a lot of distortion because of Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane, was it Irma? Irma. And that certainly was a big factor in a weak September for jobs, and it'll be very interesting. I think the market is going to look strongly at what the number is for October when those come out. I think those will come out, let's see, the 3rd, November 3rd, that's when those will come out. So that will be a big tell, I think, to see how much the job market bounces back, and if that's only a weather-related number, which likely it is. Now, 2000 and 2017, there's a whole lot of rhyming going on. I talked a little bit earlier about how likes of George Soros, Jeffrey Gundlach, Warren Buffett, Howard Marks, they're all a little spooked by the valuations in the marketplace. And if you look in the rearview mirror and go back to the dot-com collapse of 2000, and you saw the NASDAQ lose 80% of its value. The S&P was down about 50%. It should worry you, right? Berkshire Hathaway's cash position is about as big as it's ever been. Jeffrey Gundlach is one of the smartest bond managers out there, is moving towards, says investors should move towards the exits. And you're getting a lot of talk today, very similar to 2000, about, you know, a new economy and how we're going to have driverless cars and robots and the clouds transforming things. And a lot of that is true, right? A lot of it is true. The stories don't necessarily have to be wrong for the investments to be wrong, right? Because remember, back then, in 2000, there was talk about the internet revolution. And was it a revolution? Absolutely. But the valuations did not justify questionable profits and modest sales. And you're getting that in a lot of companies today. Now, if you look at most metrics like market cap to GDP, earnings, book value, Q ratio, while most of them aren't as high as they were in 2000, many today come in second place of all time. And investors currently pay the highest S&P 500 price to sales ratio and highest median price to sales ratio in history. So some metrics are actually a little higher than they were in 2000. Now, are investors less bullish than they were back in 2000? On the surface, perhaps they are. But if you look at cash allocation, they've rarely been lower. And allocation to stocks has rarely been higher. Financial assets percentage in stocks hit 64% in the dot-com era. Now it's at 55%, which is not 64%, but it's still much higher than the average, which is at about 34%. What else? What are the other red flags? Well, some might say interest rates are much lower than they were in 2000, and that's certainly true. But there are also other factors that make today's market less attractive than 2000. Like, productivity is much slower than 2000. GDP growth, much lower than in 2000. Labor force participation rate, as well as home ownership rate, lower than in 2000. What's higher than today? Well, household debt, government debt, corporate debt, all that's also higher than in 2000. So right now we're kind of in the all asset bubble. Stocks, bonds, real estate. But it emanates from the same place. Global coordinated central bank monetary policy. Now in the late 90s, it was after, remember the Asian crisis in 98? Well, after that, central banks, mainly the Fed, pumped money into the system. And that really pumped up the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ was up over 100% in 99. In 68% of folks now say they are optimistic about stock markets performing during the next year. And that ties the highest ever, which was January of 2000. Okay. And so, you know, we're long in the tooth on the economic cycle, and it's very similar. It's very similar. So, not to say there aren't opportunities, but in the growth side of things, it's very, talking about the growth side of the market, growth stocks, tech stocks, very similar to 2000. Now, you can reach me right now at 888-99-CHART.
Our Invest Talk podcast continues. One of KPP Financial's solutions that helps solve today's retirement puzzle is our balanced income portfolio. How do you get the income you need in retirement without the kind of risk that you don't feel comfortable with? That's what this program is all about, the balanced income portfolio from KPP Financial. And remember, as with each KPP program, the principals at KPP are invested right along with you. Would you like to know more about it, the balanced income portfolio? You can call 888-99-CHART and follow the prompts, or you can ask Steve about it directly. Just click on the Contact Steve button on investtalk.com. Now let's get back to the podcast. We're glad you're with us today for Invest Talk. And getting back to your questions now, our direct line is 888-99-CHART.
Yeah, hi. My name is Tariq. I'm calling from Boston. I had a question regarding the ETF called FFTY. That's F as in foreign, T as in Tom, Y as in yard, FFTY. It's based on IBD's top 50 selection. And I was wondering what you guys thought about it in terms of a long-term buy and hold. Thank you. Bye.
All right, he's looking at FFTY. This is the Innovator IBD 50. IBD has a few top 50 lists, so I'd be interested to see where this is coming from, right? What do they mean by innovator? Probably usually that kind of sounds like very tech focused, growth names. And this is a time where something like this would come about, right? It's actually 60% of the fund is in technology stocks. 18% is in consumer cyclicals, 8% financial services, 6% healthcare, 6% consumer defensive. So it's very tech focused in a time where that's kind of the flavor of the day. And so long term, I think this can do well if the 50 are actually innovators. But you have Lam Research, Stamps.com, NVIDIA. A lot of that has to do with Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, at least NVIDIA does. You know, I just don't like it. I don't like the timing of it. Odds are in the next 2 to 5 years, you're going to have a major drop in tech stocks, and this will go sync along with it. And that's when I would probably pick it up. But I would also like to see what type of track record it builds. This is something that just came out a few years back. let's see, when I think 2015 is when it came. I'm trying to get the actual chart. Yeah, it looks like 2015 is when it came out. So it's fairly new. It's had a big run. It doesn't have a lot of track record. Its expense ratio is not that high, 0.8%. It trades at a premium, a pretty pretty decent premium. I don't like that. So I'm not a fan of it. Not at these times. It's growth oriented. Just not a fan of the growth side of the market. We're value investors. If you want to trade it for momentum and try to ride this wave, sure, it might be a good tool for that, riding momentum, but from a long-term valuation standpoint, not something that I would be buying. 888-99 chart, 889-924278. We have about 20 minutes left in the show, but the show does go by quickly, so give us a call sooner rather than later. Now, recently, commodity prices have started to peak up, or perk up, sorry, shall we say. And this is kind of odd. In your more traditional, logical sense. Over the past, what call it, 10 years, roughly, the U.S., China, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan have been expanding their balance sheets through monetary policy, quantitative easing, basically printing money. Their total assets on the central bank balance sheets were about $6.5 billion in 2010, and that was after about over $2 trillion in printing money from 2009 and 10 from the Fed. So most of that $6.5 billion was the Fed, or a good chunk was. Today, the total figure of all those central banks is $18 trillion, and only about $4.5 trillion is from the Fed. So you can see what's happened is, as the Fed has slowed or stopped expanding the balance sheet in 2014, other central banks have picked up the slack, mainly the Bank of Japan and the ECB. And this has created asset price inflation. Total stock market capitalization was $54 trillion in 2010. Today, it's $87 trillion. And that's despite all the issues kind of in the world, slow economic growth still, no sign that tax code or healthcare is going to actually get overhauled, problems in North Korea, obviously the NAFTA agreement being potentially torn up, and Asian trade agreements, etc. So there's not a lot of justification for the rise, except for money printing by central banks. Now, the Fed is planning to reduce their balance sheet starting this month, right, through 2022. The ECB is planning to likely hike interest rates in November, and the Bank of Japan is showing signs of slowing its asset purchase activity. So we're kind of near the end of the rope for central bank money printing. So while there's been a positive correlation to central bank balance sheets and equity and fixed income markets, the opposite is true for commodities, which didn't really show signs of life until kind of, gold started going up beginning of last year, starting to kind of get its mojo back now, along with oil and copper and titanium. The big question is why? Well, GDP growth has been highly dependent on wealth effect of asset prices to stimulate demand, right? And commodity prices really haven't done much. So based on, if you look at measures of inflation on goods and services, they've been much slower than asset prices. So commodities need to catch up, first off. And investors have not been seeking diversification over the past 5 years. Why? Because you just sit in the indices and you're going to make money, even if asset prices are overvalued. So now you're starting to see some diversification back into commodities. Third, monetary policy today is driven less by debt and more by exchange rates. So a weaker dollar, which has happened recently, is starting to drive up asset prices. And this is what central banks are now focused on, because they've bought all the debt up pretty much, right? They've printed so much money and bought so much of the debt of the world up that the next bastion is currency exchange rates. And lastly, the People's Bank of China is loosening its controls on growth. And China has evolved to become the world's largest consumer and producer of global commodities. And so when they make a move, they tend to have a much larger influence on prices than any other nation. And I think that's only likely to continue as more things continue to be produced there. Their economy still remains, even though it's slowing in its growth, it's still growing faster than most economies in the world. So commodities are kind of getting their mojo back. And I think this is just the start of a more protracted cycle. Now, when you sign up to be an InvestTalk Insider, you get the key to all kinds of useful information and lists that can make your investing life easier and more productive. Now, example is our library of webinars that you can access anytime. It's all free. Never a charge for any of it. Sign up, go to investtalk.com, click on the InvestTalk tab.
Choosing the right investment products, adjusting to life's surprise events. If it's about money and it's important to you, we want to know more about it. We're here for you. 888-99-CHART is how to reach Steve or Justin right now on InvestTalk.
Let's go to BJ in Fremont. How are you doing, BJ?
I'm doing good. Thanks for taking my call. I have a very generic question for you. Mm-hmm. And I think you are right that today everything is a little bit more expensive. Most of the major companies are doing well. Their stock is at 45 degrees to the norm. Now, when you look for the value stock, what are the parameters you look and what? Where does it qualify as a value stock? What characteristics you look into?
Well, typically what you're looking for are low price to book values, high operating earnings yield, right? So, which is the inverse of, so earnings yield is the inverse of the P ratio. So a low P ratio will give you a high earnings yield. And then we like to focus on the operating side of earnings so that it strips out any of the ancillary parts of the business, one-off earnings, etc. So we look at operating earnings yield. Then enterprise value to EBITDA. So enterprise value encompasses both the value of its stock and also how much debt they have, net debt on their balance sheet. So if you bought the whole company and you wanted to pay off all the debts and own the company outright, what would it cost you? And that's the enterprise value. So it's a little bit more important, a lot more important, I think, than just market cap itself, which is what you're looking at when you're looking at PE, price to earnings. You're only looking at that market cap. And EBITDA is earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization, which interests can be eliminated if you pay off the debt. Taxes can be manipulated using accounting. Depreciation, same thing. Amortization, same thing. So that's a measure that I like to look at, enterprise value to EBITDA. So that under like a 10 to 12 is kind of a good starting area, and anything lower than that tends to be pretty good value. And then you look at profitability metrics, right? Positive cash flow, positive free cash flow. What does that look like compared to enterprise value? Return on invested capital, that's a big metric for me to figure out what type of return is the business making on the capital that is within the business, both debt and equity. Then you have payout ratios, that they do pay a dividend. Is it lower than 60%, higher than 60%? What is that in relation to the cash flow of the business? I'm just kind of scratching the surface here, but there's a lot that goes into that. You can go into enterprise value to revenue. There's so much to really dig into. So there's a lot of metrics that we look at that matter for us. And it's going to matter. So some metrics matter more or less depending on an industry. And they also matter more or less depending on the growth of the business, how strong their brand is, right? If they have a very stable and strong business with a strong ecosystem, then we're going to give it a little more leeway than a company that maybe is in the commodity space where they're kind of at the whims of the marketplace, right? So,
yeah. Is there any suggestion for average investors like us, some services that we can avail to get data along those lines?
Well, I talked a little bit earlier. Morningstar.com is a great starting point. You can get a lot of the basic information like profitability of the business, return on invested capital, return on equity, debt to equity ratio. You can get net margins, gross margins, cash flow, all of those you can get for free. Both you get today's figures and going back 10 years as well, and a nice flow chart that makes it very, very easy to kind of dig into. Now, we also use Y charts, we use Reuters, Bloomberg reports that give us a lot of that information as well. Those you have to pay for. So it just depends how much you want to pay. So there's plenty of services out there that will give you a lot of this information. It's a matter of how much you want to pay annually. I think Y charts, we pay somewhere around $4,000 a year is what we pay for that. Morningstar, I think they're about $100 a month if you subscribe to it, which gives you a little bit more in-depth reports and things like that. So you just have to go and see which one works for you. What metrics do you like to look at? And how do you like it laid out? And how much are you willing to pay for the services that give you a little bit more information, gives you filters, gives you kind of a little bit more tools that will help you find the best investments out there.
Really appreciate that information. Thank you very much.
No problem, BJ. Thanks for the call. Good question. It's remember, this is an art. Reading a chart's an art. Figuring out the valuation of a company, whether something is over or undervalued, you're never going to know for sure. And even if you are highly confident that you're buying something that's undervalued, you're never going to know exactly how undervalued it is. So we're here to help. But hopefully we're not the only resource for you as well. Now you're listening to Invest Talk. Last week, Steve talked about ETFs of ETFs, like the funds of funds you may have in your 401k. That's usually what the target date funds are. They're funds of funds. Do you have questions about that? I'm open to any money topic. Reach me now at 888-99-CHART. Chart 888-992-4278. We have 5 minutes left in the show, so if you're going to call in, you got to do it now. Now, the price of Bitcoin has gone up a lot. There's a lot of talk about it. I see it everywhere. It's the classic sign of quite the bubble. And it's not to say that there isn't something there. There is great technology behind it. Blockchain is a technology that is likely here to stay. It will be developed. It will be used in private and probably eventually in the public domain. Maybe certain governments come out with their own currency built on the blockchain for various reasons. And a lot of it's security reasons, tracking, etc., which frankly governments like, right? Governments like that we're using credit cards to purchase everything because that can be tracked, right? And what happens when you can track something? You can tax it. So governments like the idea of a currency that is easily transparent, open, and tracked so that they can take their cut. And that's one of the reasons why Japan has kind of started to regulate fintech a little bit and allowed it to operate pretty freely within the country. But then there's countries like China who are kind of cracking down, right? They see it as a tool for people to send money abroad, right? Capital flight. They see it as a way to avoid taxes because at this point, there isn't government tracking of it, right? It isn't really that much on these transactions aren't really on the radar of governments. And most of the transactions in the cryptocurrency space are just traders. They're not exactly trading assets or goods and services. Some are, but the vast majority of transactions are just speculation. So the Chinese government has actually banned Bitcoin exchanges. Now we in the United States are taking some tentative steps to follow in Japan's footsteps, but the end game is still kind of up in the air. Now, the biggest problem that most people are missing with Bitcoin is that the governments will never allow it to supplant central bank issued money. Just the bottom line. It's one thing for them to allow small anonymous transactions, but it's an entirely different matter for governments to allow this to be used everywhere, anonymously, which would make it very difficult to collect taxes and counter any criminal activity. Carrying paper currency out of a country, money laundering, is a major cost for tax evaders and criminals, and this allows them to escape it. So that is what really will bring down the cryptocurrency space, is when governments say, uh-uh, we want our cut, we want our say, we want to regulate it, and that's when things will change dramatically. Let's try to answer one more question before our hour is up at 888-99-CHART. What? We don't have time. Sorry. I was long-winded with my Bitcoin conversation. So we're kind of out of time. So hope everyone enjoyed the show. I hope you learned something. And our hour is up. I'm financial advisor and licensed realtor, real estate consultant Justin Klein, chief executive officer of KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm. Glad you'd be with us. On behalf of Steve Peasley and the whole KPP family, I want to thank you for being here. Let's meet again here tomorrow. A reminder, personalized retirement portfolio reviews are available without charge no matter where you live in the U.S. Just go to investtalk.com, click on the Invest Talk tab, and then Portfolio Review.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461.
InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.